Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Patty Miller is professor of Managing People in Organizations at IESCE Business School. Dr. Miller is the author of a recent book, Mission Critical Leadership. Dr. Miller specializes in leadership, change management, and innovation with a focus on multinational organizations. Dr. Miller has also become extensively involved in the challenges faced by organizations during transition to globalization. Patty, welcome to Edgewise.
Thank you very much for inviting me on your program.
Patty, why is there so much interest today in innovation?
Innovation is absolutely critical. If you look at it in the context of the movement of jobs in both the U.S. and Europe, we have found over the last decade that any job that can be automated, any job for which there's a standard procedure, for which there's somebody in India or China who can do it for half the price and even less, we've moved that job or we're moving those jobs. The issue then is, what are we doing here in the States and what are we doing in Europe?
Okay.
If you look at where I come from in Spain, 30 years ago, it was all about manual labor. We built motor cars. Today, we can no longer do that. We've got people in Eastern Europe and in Asia who can build those cars for us. So there's tremendous pressure on our communities and our society to utilize the brain power that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And that brain power is going to be focused on innovation.
Right.
The only thing we can do is be creative, use all our capability rather than using just our hands.
Now, in the U.S., and for that matter, Europe, there does appear to be a problem in companies about being innovative. Why is there this problem?
Part of the problem starts with the way we've tackled innovation and the way we train innovation. So if you look at training programs, if you look at executive development programs, what they tend to do is create what we call a brainstorm island. You go away on a course, and it's a weekend or it's a five-day course, and you spend some days working out how you can be creative,
mm-hmm.
and you have things like brainstorming, ideation, let's break into teams, let's have a lot of fun while we invent a new car for Ford or for Fiat. And we do all kinds of things like that.
Yeah.
You're trapped on Brainstorm Island. You wear your Hawaiian shirt, you drink pina coladas, and you have dancing girls. The problem is, when you get back to work, there's a real challenge. How do I transition from Brainstorm Island back to the workplace?
Right, right.
What we've found is that the majority of managers have no idea how to transition the ideas and the creativity of Brainstorm Island back into the workplace. There are examples of companies that are successful, and there are leaders who are successful at this, but the vast majority of people can't get that right, and that's the problem. So we are stuck in a model which says we have a new product development model. How do you make a new product? We teach our people how to do that. We never tell them, how do you manage creativity in the workplace? How do you make creativity sustainable back in the workplace, as opposed to Brainstorm Island? That problem goes very deep.
Oh, yes.
And I'm sure most of your listeners will have experienced this. You go on a three-day Brainstorm Island. You're tremendously motivated, and you get back to work. The safest thing is probably for your people to hide away for a few days because they know that within a week you will start losing steam and within a month you will have forgotten about Brainstorm Island.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as they can stay out of your way while you're getting over this experience, they're all right.
Right.
That is one of the fundamental problems, the way we train innovation.
Seems to me what happens is that individuals learn ways to be personally creative while they're on Brainstorm Island. But when they come back to the office, they may be creative, but their creativity may have no impact because either there are processes or cultural issues that impede this.
Yes. The problem is that we have designed many of our systems and processes in such a way as to prevent people from being creative. On Brainstorm Island, we always say, what we'd like you to be is creative, and we'd like you to make mistakes. Because if you make mistakes, we can celebrate mistakes. Now, if you look at most organizations, does that qualify as baloney?
Absolutely.
I mean, you get punished for mistakes big time, especially in this economic situation we found ourselves in. We're not celebrating mistakes.
Of course not.
No, we're saying, please, if it's going to be a mistake, make it a $10 mistake. We do not need a $1 million mistake. And the whole culture limits and constrains creativity and innovation. So you get back from Brainstorm Island, and here's the problem. In order to sustain the innovation in your organization, you've got to redesign the system.
Exactly.
So we've designed a whole process in which the leader of innovation becomes what we call the innovation architect. He or she has to think, not am I generating lots of ideas, but around me, people are generating those ideas. How do I structure? How do I design the creative workspace inside the organization, outside the organization, with my customers, with my suppliers, so that we can sustain this whole thing? So it's not just 1 week, 1 month, or whatever. It's about how do I keep this thing going? So the innovation architect focuses on the starting point of strategy.
For instance,
can I take a better decision about innovation? There are lots of ideas around, but can I improve my chances of making a good decision, of seeing a good idea?
Okay.
If you go to any course, people hammer on about iPod and Steve Jobs and how fantastic that was. But the most interesting part of the whole iPod story is, in fact, not Apple and iPod. It's Sony. How come I didn't see iPod is the question that you have in a massive organization like Sony. Why didn't we see that? Why weren't we there? The whole thing that you have MP3 on the table for a decade, and you're looking at it every day you go to work, you say, there's something here.
Right.
That's the problem of most organizations. You find that we can spend a lot on Brainstorm Island in getting people to generate ideas. But when you get back to the organization, are you going to be able to implement those ideas? And have you got that creativity embedded into your culture?
Very interesting.
You know, there's a nice story about Churchill. Everybody talks about Churchill and leadership. Churchill never had any difficulty with ideas. He always had lots of ideas. But he did have a chief of staff, Alan Brooke, who got in his way all the time. Alan Brooke used to say, that idea is terrible. That's an awful idea. Sometimes he said, that's a great idea.
Okay.
Their relationship was quite confrontational. Churchill, on occasions, actually asked colleagues, why does Alan Brooke hate me so? And Alan Brooke responded by saying, I don't hate him. I love him, but I would be totally disloyal were I to agree with one of his ideas if I myself did not believe in it. The question is, who appointed this guy? And of course, you know who? Churchill. He knew he needed somebody to improve his hit rate on ideas. And Alan Brooke was the structural filter to his ideas. Mm-hmm. So decision-making is a critical thing, because in the research that we've done for the book that we're writing, and also on the programs that we've done, what we've found is that most divisional general managers, most leaders of groups, of branch managers and so on, do not need training in generating more and more ideas. What they need really is being able to see a good idea and add something. Being able to say, that's interesting. I think you need to talk to so-and-so who's sitting over there. And those two ideas would actually make a fantastic new process, system, product, or whatever. That is your role. It's not one of saying, last night I was in the shower, I had a fantastic idea. Forget it. No, your role as a leader here is to put those ideas together. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard of Dick Rowe. Four young gentlemen came to him and played their music. He said to them, lads, it's not on. I mean, rock music is all over.
Oh, yes.
When they spoke to a man called George Martin, he said, you've got something there. I think we can use it. They were the Beatles.
Right.
So the question is, are you a Dick Rowe or are you a George Martin? Do you not see it or do you see it and add something? That's the exciting part of being an innovation architect.
In your observation of various companies, have you found innovation architects and programs that companies should try to emulate?
The two levels that you see innovation architects at work. One is at a CEO level. So if you look at what has happened in Procter & Gamble, and this is a well-worn tale, A.G. Lafley takes over the business, the share price falls when he takes it over, and he gets to work in restructuring the business, restructuring the R&D centers that he has, the technical centers, restructuring the processes so as to incorporate people who went before, customers, suppliers, and so on. So you see here an innovation architect with a very large worldview of how it should operate and a strategy to encompass a global business. But most of the people we research, of course, don't have that opportunity. For every A.G. Lafley, CEO of Procter & Gamble, $70 or $80 billion business, you have hundreds and thousands of general managers who are running a small division of a business, a small branch, a country division or a product division of a business.
Right.
Being an innovation architect there is a different type of challenge. It's a challenge because most managers at that level are on the move. They don't stay in that job forever. As they've been promoted, as they're moving in the organization, they'd only spend 2 or 3 years there. So they drive innovation into the division. But do they make it sustainable so that when they walk out of the door, does the innovation stay or does it leave with them? Is it embedded in the culture or is it that they have an agenda which travels with them?
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. We've looked at companies. We looked at companies like Abbott in Chicago and worked with a number of their general managers running countries. That might involve if you're in Denmark or the Gulf region, 100 people in your division, quite a small business. You can turn that business into a $50 or $60 million business if you can get the creativity embedded in 100 people so that they understand what it's about and they're thinking about innovation all the time. It's a priority for them.
Mm-hmm.
In a business like Abbott, you might look at Italy. 3,000 people in a culture like Italy's where, to put it mildly, I think most people have a kind of socialistic tendency. They feel they're not going to be fired. There's not a lot of pressure on them. If they do their jobs, they're quite well protected by the law and the state and so on. So when the new general manager walks in the door, they look at him or her and say, well, it's going to be here for 3 years, and maybe if I can avoid them for the 3 years. We found the job of the innovation architect there to be a much broader job, a much bigger job, where you might actually have to, in the design of the processes, leave quite a number of people out of that process. So you might focus on 50 people mm-hmm. who will be part of your innovation initiative in the organization, because you can't carry 3,000 people. So Abbott in the last couple of years has been extremely successful embedding into different cultures so that if you move around the world, you will see creativity actually happening in a different way, depending on the very culture. Very successful in that sense.
Patty, can you tell me another company that has done well in innovation and why?
If you look at Pixar or Google, for example, these are new types of organizations, with new structures, with very young people in them. They bring with them a sense of newness, a sense of excitement, and they've been very successful. If you look at their cultures, they're fantastic.
Absolutely.
The problem is, if you're working in a company like Henkel in Germany, here's a company that's 100 years old, and its employees are more mature, to put it in a sort of European sense, meaning older. They've been successful, and they've done it in a particular way. Now they're saying, yeah, but I look at this Pixar thing. I mean, what do I do with this stuff? So it is quite difficult for those companies to take it on. And you see now under a new CEO, Henkel, really trying very hard to change its culture, to be more creative and to do more innovation, but much more of a challenge in doing that, the mm-hmm. old companies as opposed to the new companies.
We've been speaking to Dr. Patty Miller, author of a recent book, Mission Critical Leadership. Patty, thanks for being with us on Edgewise.
Thank you very much for inviting me on your program.
Remember, we'd really like your feedback, so please drop us an email note at podcast@amanet.org or call us at 800-697-3406. That's 800-697-3406. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.